come over me. I will look at a piece of bread, and suddenly I feel sure that it has been poisoned. I try to talk myself out of this belief, but usually solve the problem by simply putting the food away. Despite Hesse's above-average intelligence, Kelly noted his inconsistent memory symptoms and was certain that they represented both malingering and hysteria, or what would today be called dissociation. One of Hesse's former secretaries tried to help him reclaim his memory by giving him an old photograph to look at, but Hesse waved it away, saying, "I do not want any help." Kelly noted, "It was obvious to all present that he did not want to run any risk of giving himself away." Kelly commented that Hesse's memory switched off and on, sometimes volitionally, and sometimes when he was under great emotional pressure. Hesse later told him that much of his amnesia had been real, and that his boast in court had been false. He continued that although his mind was improving, it was still weak, and my brain tires easily. To support his assertion that Hesse was not always malingering, Kelly noted that the amnesia was not providing any gain. It interfered with his defense and handicapped his lawyer. It did not get him off the case, but actually thrust him back into it. In January 1946, Kelly wrote, "His flight to England was a grandiose gesture, which, when unsuccessful, resulted in the development of a severe paranoid reaction with delusions of persecution by the British. He also developed some partial amnesia, and as the amnesia became deeper, the paranoid reactions vanished. After his second suicidal attempt, the amnesia cleared and the paranoid reactions returned. These reactions again vanished with the development of the amnesia which was present on his arrival at Nuremberg. His dramatic statement in court was a hysterical theatrical reaction. Careful examination made here shows that Hesse still has some true areas of amnesia. He admits that at times he is unable to remember certain events, and that this process has occurred off and on for many years. His paranoid reactions are in the area between conscious and unconscious. He has enough insight to realize that the idea that the food may be poisoned is not rational. On the other hand, these ideas do recur. He may also develop a recurrence of his amnesia, and it is extremely likely that he will produce some hysterical gesture before he is finally disposed of." Kelly bemoaned Hesse's aloofness. "On my departure, he was the only prisoner who failed to thank me for my interest in his welfare. This is typical of Hesse's personality, a paranoid and suspicious individual with gross hysterical manifestations, who failed in the most spectacular effort of his life. He considers himself to be the only standard-bearer left of the Nazi Party, and will continue true to his adolescent ideals to the end, provided, of course, that his basic instability does not precipitate another psychotic episode." Kelly's prison chart note on Hesse was more restrained. It concluded that Hesse had no evidence of psychopathology. In this brief note dated December 13, 1945, one recognizes the familiar cadence of a contemporary psychiatric examination. Hesse was frequently aloof and at times not cooperative. His psychomotor reactions were slowed, and mood was described as flat. Kelly noted marked hysterical trends and mild paranoid reaction, ideas of being poisoned, similar to those he manifested in England. At the time of this assessment, his memory was intact, but Kelly added a cautionary clause, "at present." The term mild paranoid reaction is a relic of diagnostic language in the 1940s. Until DSM-II appeared in 1968, all psychiatric disorders were called reactions, reflecting a belief that they were not so much entities as they were responses to the environment. The term mild also gives us pause. Kelly is clearly distinguishing Hesse from flagrantly paranoid patients who may be found in emergency rooms or psychiatric hospitals. However, the fact that Kelly used paranoid at all indicates that he thought Hesse was more than just suspicious. But what did he mean by hysterical? This is trickier. In 1945, hysteria would have meant something like flamboyantly overexpressive or theatrically dramatic. In other writings, Kelly gave a radically different assessment, calling Hesse insane, an introverted, shy, withdrawn personality who, suspicious of everything about him, projected upon his environment concepts developing within himself. He went on to describe Hesse as emotionally juvenile, the only prisoner who failed to recognize the reality of his situation, to admit the total defeat of Nazism. He was a paranoid and childish individual, with gross hysterical manifestations, who had always failed in whatever he attempted. Later, as he realizes that he will not hang, he may relax and appear to recover. However, Hess will continue to live always in the borderlands of insanity. In typical Kelly fashion, he concluded, "Diagrammatically, if one considers the street as sanity and the sidewalk as insanity, then Hess spent the greater part of his time on the curb." Gilbert's assessment. Gilbert was more successful than Kelly in relating to Hess, but Gilbert acknowledged that Hess was so negativistic, secretive, and amnesiac that very little information could be obtained from him directly. Gilbert gave him a copy of his indictment, and Hess returned it after writing, "I can't remember, Rudolf Hess." Gilbert described Hess's apathetic absent-mindedness, but thought that his forgetting had a theatrical quality, and that Hess was deliberately suppressing a recollection that flickered through his clouded mind. Gilbert was a careful methodologist who documented Hess's memory with repeated testing sessions from December 1945 to June 1946. Gilbert was scientific in his approach, repeatedly asking Hess about his memory of various events in his life. For instance, he asked whether Hess could remember his childhood or his membership in the Nazi Party. After certain pivotal events in the trial, Gilbert asked if Hess remembered the testimony. He also tested his memory with digit span calculations. In December 1945, Hess had normal recall of his life events and superior memory in the digit span test. Thereafter, his memory faded. He couldn't remember childhood events, joining the Nazi Party, or his flight to England. He couldn't remember ongoing testimony at the trial. Sometimes, Hess described his amnesia to Gilbert as a pretense. At other times, he stated that his thinking and ability to concentrate were clearing up. Hess continued worrying about his food. He attributed his headaches, diarrhea, and confusion to poisoned crackers, and he asked all sorts of people to sample his crackers, Kelly, Gilbert, even his fellow prisoners. Would they get the same reactions, or was this batch of crackers safe? His fellow prisoners had reached their own conclusions. Schacht said succinctly, "By the way, Hess is crazy." Gilbert patiently ate one of Hess's biscuits, telling him calmly, "Well, I'll let you know if the crackers give me a headache or any ill effects." Gilbert struggled to understand Hess intellectually and emotionally. He also tried to give Hess various face-saving ways of surmounting his amnesia, suggesting that if he rested, or perhaps kept a diary, his ability to concentrate would improve and his memory would follow. It was a shrewd clinical intervention, but it's not clear that it helped. Hess's complaint shifted from amnesia to difficulties concentrating, and then to his recurring abdominal pains. Hess was pretty sure that somebody was doing this to him, perhaps Colonel Andrus. Most of the other prisoners had somatic problems, including stomach aches, headaches, palpitations, and insomnia. All pretty much what one would expect in a stressful situation. But with Hess, these preoccupations were all-consuming. The Rorschachs. Kelly noted Hess's response to Rorschach card 2 as two men talking about a crime, blood is on their minds. Kelly had administered thousands of Rorschach tests, and he noted that the blood response was not terribly rare. However, Hess then went off on a tangent and became preoccupied with the bloody thoughts, which were a projection of his bloody memories. Hess reported bizarre elements on other card responses, which Kelly viewed as demonstrating anxiety and abnormal thinking. He summarized the Rorschach in one brief sentence. "Indicates basic hysterical personality without evidence of psychosis," and concluded, "This man is competent and demonstrates no evidence of psychopathology." He commented that Hess's suspicious responses to the Rorschach were not so extensive as to suggest an active paranoid process, but that a psychotic episode could develop in the future. Hess suffers from a true psychoneurosis, primarily of the hysterical type, which is engrafted upon a basic paranoid personality, Kelly wrote. In other words, Hess is an introverted, shy, withdrawn personality who basically is suspicious of his environment and projects upon his surroundings concepts developing within himself. He continued that Hess's Rorschach revealed some bizarre responses, such as marked shock reactions to the color and shade cards, tension during the test, the crude use of color and shade, and some shifting in the form quality. Kelly felt that Hess was suffering from an hysterical amnesic reaction, but it was equally obvious that a large portion of his total amnesia was deliberately assumed. Gilbert noted that Hess was very guarded and offered minimal responses to the Rorschach cards. Typically, people report seeing two or three different things on each of the 10 cards. Hess reported just 15 responses to the whole deck. Gilbert noted the lifelessness of the figure seen, showing lack of empathy and inner life, and emotional instability shown in the poor color control, breaking out into the hysterical blood response. In contrast to a typical Rorschach, where people will report that at least some blots have movement, for example, seeing a flying bat, Hess's reports were devoid of movement and vitality. Gilbert also noted cryptically that he readministered the Rorschach to Hess, but it did not show any improvement in the limited cognitive and creative ideational capacities upon retest. He concluded that Hess showed severely constricted affect and lack of emotional contact characteristic of the schizoid personality. Evaluating Hess in the 21st century. Hess mystified observers in 1945. Most courtroom spectators thought that he was insane. Gilbert and Kelly, as well as the international experts, noted a host of maladies, but felt that he was competent to stand trial. Everyone agreed that Hess had poor reality testing. His grandiose flight to Scotland was bizarre in the extreme. How could the deputy Führer have concluded that he could make an unauthorized and spontaneous peace treaty? Everyone also granted that Hess was exaggerating his symptoms, although the extent of that exaggeration was debatable. If he were evaluated today, could we do any better? We can answer this question using clinical tools available in routine practice, as well as research probes that are not yet routinely employed. Routine practice has come a long way in specifying diagnostic criteria, but in Nuremberg, there were no widely agreed upon criteria for determining what were hallmark signs of various psychiatric disorders. Indeed, the ideology of the time emphasized in the continuity of human experience that symptoms blended into each other like pigments in a watercolor wash. Since 1980, when DSM-3 was published, psychiatrists and psychologists have used increasingly precise diagnostic guidelines for recognizing psychiatric disorders, but there are still two enormous problems. Far more often than we would like, people's problems blur at the edges. I am, I suppose, a DSM Mandarin, having been involved in writing the current DSM-5, but even I have to admit that our criteria are merely guidelines. So-called textbook cases are not all that common. Instead, patients commonly straddle two or more diagnoses, and we must rely on clinical judgment to diagnose and treat them. The other problem, assuming truthfulness, is even more problematic. Doctors assume that patients are telling the truth, yet patients forget, dissemble, and distort their history and symptoms. This is a problem for all medical specialties, but psychiatric is particularly vulnerable to distorted history because we have so few physical findings or laboratory tests to guide diagnostic decision-making. Especially in forensic contexts, we have a higher index of suspicion that the patient is not being candid, but by and large we rely on the patient's report and the doctor's judgment about the veracity of the symptoms. David Rosenhan and colleagues famously demonstrated that if healthy normal control subjects came to a psychiatric hospital falsely reporting that they had once heard atypical auditory hallucinations, the doctors would admit the patients and try to help them. In other words, the default assumption is that patients are telling the truth as they see it, unless there is good reason to doubt them. Why else would someone go to the time, expense, and trouble of seeing us? In forensic settings, however, lying is the rule. 20-30% of violent criminal defendants will claim that they don't remember their crime, but we have helpful tools for characterizing the nature of their amnesia. From a clinical perspective, we could probably fit Hess into a number of diagnostic categories, but it might take some pushing and shoving to make them precise. He could certainly be diagnosed as malingering. Alternatively, he could be viewed as having a dissociative disorder, a somatic symptom disorder, schizophrenia, or a delusional disorder. We would probably do a better job than the psychiatrists of 1945 because we would specify exactly which criteria Hess manifested. But the fact is, Hess probably suffered from multiple psychiatric disorders. As Shakespeare put it, "When sorrows come, they come not single spies, but in battalions." Even if doctors had been more precise in flagging each of Hess's symptoms, we would be puzzled today by his waxing and waning paranoia. In today's experience, when a patient like Hess reports an uptick of delusions, the first thing we suspect is that the patient has stopped taking his or her medication. 70 years ago, when there were no medications for treating schizophrenia, doctors were accustomed to the recurring onset and offset of psychotic symptoms. But today we are less familiar with the clinical course of patients who have never taken antipsychotic drugs. Researchers have a somewhat easier time with this because there are some research probes that can help confirm a diagnosis of schizophrenia. For example, genetic markers and measuring the neural response to startle. However, these remain research tools and are not incorporated in clinical practice. There are also many types of lie detector devices, but detecting lies with polygraphs, event-related potentials, brain imaging, or pupillary response is only marginally useful because of false positives and negatives. Cognitive testing is one area where researchers have made enormous strides since 1945. Confronted with Hess today, a forensic neuropsychologist would certainly be able to identify whether he was exaggerating his symptoms. However, once the exaggeration was noted, it would be difficult to distinguish between dissociation and malingering. That distinction is made by inferring motivation and intentionality, never an easy task. Sadly, I'm not so sure that today's clinicians and researchers would do much better at diagnosing Hess than our colleagues who saw him from 1941 to 1946. The end. There are some who believe that the Allies treated Hess unfairly, and as a result, he faked everything, hoodwinking both the psychiatrists and the court. He had flown to Scotland on a mission for peace and had been locked up and never given an opportunity to meet with the proper authorities. He pretended to have amnesia because it got him out of interrogation. He saved samples of his food, wrapped in paper and sealing wax, because it gave him something to do. He worried that his food was being poisoned, but it must be allowed that the intelligence community did in fact have considerable interest in drugs and mind control. I don't think that such arguments stand up to his consistently abnormal behavior, which extended over years, spanning events before, during, and even after the trial. In 1946, the experts were clear in stating that Hess did not fit one clear diagnostic category. He was obsessed about his health and would have been diagnosed as having hypochondriasis or somatization disorder in DSM-4, or as having somatic symptom disorder in DSM-5. He also manifested spotty and inconsistent memory loss. Some of this amnesia appeared outside of his volitional control and would be viewed today as dissociative amnesia. At other times, the amnesia appeared to be willfully exaggerated in order to limit his interrogation. This would be an instance of malingering, not a psychiatric disorder at all. Last, he was a deeply suspicious man, convinced that he was being poisoned. All his life he had had peculiar ideas about food, contamination, and additives. Today I suspect that most psychiatrists would diagnose him as having paranoid schizophrenia. In his final statement to the court on August 31, 1946, Hess gave a long and rambling statement, complaining that he was surrounded by people with glassy, strange eyes, and recalling that in the Moscow show trials, the defendants also had glazed and dreamy eyes. After 20 minutes of this, the judges said that this had gone on long enough and that he should conclude. Hess pulled himself together, no longer talked about glassy eyes, and instead stated, I was permitted to work for many years of my life under the greatest son whom my people has brought forth in its thousand-year history. I do not regret anything. The judges must have been struck by this curious testimony that juxtaposed paranoid delusions about glassy eyes with defiant loyalty to Hitler. Rebecca West described the day of sentencing. The darkened mind of Hess passed through some dreadful crisis. He ran his hands over his brows again and again, as if he were trying to brush away cobwebs, but the blackness covered him. All humanity left his face. It became an agonized muzzle. He began to swing backwards and forwards on his seat with the regularity of a pendulum. He was taken away soon, but it was as if the door of hell had swung ajar. The tribunal sentenced Hess to lifetime imprisonment in Spandau Prison in Berlin. He was sent there together with six other war criminals, but from 1966 on, he was the sole prisoner in this large, forbidding structure. He continued being deeply suspicious and complained of stomach pains, wailing into the night and refusing to see his wife and son for many years. On August 17, 1987, at age 93, Rudolf Hess hanged himself in Spandau. It was an ironic and troubling end to a man who had dodged hanging at Nuremberg 41 years previously. Spandau prison was demolished, lest it become a neo-Nazi shrine. In its place stands a modern shopping center. Part 4. Coda to Nuremberg. Rorschachs and recriminations. Chapter 9. Douglas Kelly and Gustav Gilbert. A collaboration from hell. Insanity is no explanation for the Nazis. They were simply creatures of their environment, as all humans are, and they were also, to a greater degree than most humans are, the makers of their environment. Douglas Kelly, 22 cells in Nuremberg, 1947. What kind of animal species is it that organizes and executes senseless, cold-blooded, systematic slaughter of endless numbers of its own members? Gustav Gilbert, The Mentality of SS Murderous Robots, 1963. The Early Partnership. I wondered what happened to Kelly and Gilbert after completing their duties at Nuremberg. What does it do to someone who encounters malice so close up? Kelly and Gilbert sat, day in and day out, cheek by jowl, with the war criminals. Sitting on a small cot with Stryker and his ilk sandwiched between the two of them brought them uncomfortably close to repellent behavior, and it appears that a little of that malice rubbed off on them. The dank odor of the place, the pressure cooker environment, and the ever-present rubble of warfare on the streets offered them no respite. Most of us would be on edge in such circumstances. If we had a close friend or loved one with us, we would get through it, perhaps somewhat the worse for wear. Alas, Kelly and Gilbert had only each other, and they weren't exactly close friends. They weren't even good collaborators. I always tell my trainees, be careful in your choice of collaborators. A good collaboration is like a good marriage. A bad one, well, is as bad as a bad marriage can be, filled with stalking and years of lawyers. Kelly and Gilbert's collaboration fell more in the latter category. Thrown together by circumstance and convenience, their roles and responsibilities were unclearly defined, and their worldviews differed profoundly. They shared little in common: brilliance, strong personal ambition, and a deep interest in understanding the Nazi leaders. Kelly's strengths were his easygoing garrulousness, which attracted people as diverse as war criminals and newspaper reporters. Gilbert's strengths were his seriousness and attention to detail. They both devoted considerable time to the prisoners, amassing a wealth of notes, observations, and Rorschach results. Kelly got there first, reporting to Ashcan on August 4, 1945, and leaving Nuremberg in January 1946. Gilbert had a longer duty, from October 23, 1945, to October 1946. Predictably, their timelines were a source of rivalry. I got there first versus I was there longer. Their collaboration on a book about Nuremberg was a poorly kept secret. Kelly loved talking with reporters, and even Quiet Gilbert disclosed to a Pravda correspondent that they were writing a book. All this leaked back to Warden Andrus, who was not at all pleased. The Rupture. Kelly left Nuremberg taking all his notes, and, Gilbert claimed, his notes as well. According to Gilbert, Kelly said that he was no longer interested in their book project on the Nazi prisoners, and instead planned on writing a book about racial prejudice. In reality, Kelly was already trying to negotiate a book contract about the Nuremberg work. A couple of weeks after his departure, Kelly wrote Gilbert from the United States, asking for copies of more interviews and transcripts from the trial. Gilbert declined. When Kelly left Nuremberg, he embarked on a flurry of ill-advised interviews with the press. He loved being in the center of attention and told extravagant stories about Nuremberg that were big hits in the tabloids. In August 1946, he gave an interview to Howard Whitman at the Sunday Express entitled, "What Goering and Company Talk About in Their Cells." As if this wasn't provocative enough, Whitman placed an even longer version of the Kelly interview weeks later in Collier's, with a headline, "Squeal, Nazi, Squeal." The Nuremberg court personnel were not amused. Sir Geoffrey Lawrence, presiding judge of the Nuremberg Tribunal, complained to Warden Andrus, who in turn filed a written complaint, which I came across in Andrus's papers at the U.S. Army Military History Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Kelly had left the Army months before, and Andrus was under no illusion that anything could be done about Kelly's indiscretions. But one senses that Andrus, ever correct and punctilious, wrote his complaint for the record. It wasn't all tabloid fluff. In a series of articles, Kelly started to reveal his unique perspective on the war criminals. He presented a preliminary paper on the Nazi Rorschachs at a meeting in New York in April 1946, which he subsequently published in the Rorschach Research Exchange. The paper offers a preliminary sketch of his ideas. The Nazis were essentially sane, and they knew precisely what they were doing during their years of ruthless domination. We must also realize that such personalities exist in this country, and there are undoubtedly certain individuals who would willingly climb over the corpses of one half of the people of the United States, if by doing so they could thereby be given control of the other half. In a subsequent interview in The New Yorker, Kelly continued in the same vein. With the exception of Dr. Lay, there wasn't an insane Joe in the crowd. I've never met 21 people who considered themselves so pure and lily-white. The New Yorker article offered a wonderful overview of Kelly's thoughts and a glimpse of how astonishingly gifted he was at characterizing people. Goering is a buccaneer. In the old days he would have had a fine house ashore, loved his wife and children, held great parties, slipped away during the evening to sink a ship and every living soul on board, and then returned to the party and had the time of his life. Regarding Goering's drug withdrawal at Ashcan, Kelly noted that he complained of pains in his legs and thighs. I told him he was acting the way Ribbentrop would act, and he never complained again. His description of Hess was vivid. Hess is a delayed adolescent, the kind of fellow who would attend marshmallow roasts and campfires and watch parades with his mouth open. Meanwhile, back in Nuremberg, Gilbert stewed. Kelly was stealing the limelight.
The War of the Books. In between his many press interviews and speeches, Kelly wrote 22 Cells in Nuremberg and entered negotiations on a book contract with Simon & Schuster. Meanwhile, Gilbert, back at Nuremberg, was writing his own book, Nuremberg Diary, and began negotiating a contract with Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Kelly was ahead in the book race with his short book. Gilbert's book would be longer than Kelly's, but it was still incomplete. The publishers knew of the competition and urged both authors to write quickly, but ultimately the competing manuscripts would blight each other's prospects. Simon & Schuster declined Kelly's book, but a small publishing house, Greenberg, published the book in 1947. It met with mixed reviews. One reviewer wrote, "I found it so interesting that I could scarcely skip a page. One of the major appeals is the non-technical language." Continuing insightfully, he said, While I compliment the book on its admirable objectivity for students of human nature and the social sciences, I believe this same objectivity could be easily misunderstood by the general public as a too sympathetic account of the Nazi mentality. Other reviewers were less sympathetic and were offended by Kelly's breezy style. A prominent psychoanalyst confided to publisher Greenberg, "I find it such trash that, frankly, I regret that you are publishing it. It is not even good reporting, much less good psychiatry." Style aside, the book deeply angered readers by suggesting that the Nazi Revolution was not the fabrication of warped minds out of the wards of a psychopathic hospital, but the creation of ordinary men, not unlike many with whom we brush elbows every day in the United States. Eventually, Gilbert published The Nuremberg Diary. Predictably, the two books had different styles, and given the antagonism between the two men, they and their followers emphasized their differences rather than their many similarities. It is striking that neither of these classic books discussed the Rorschachs, other than in passing. Instead, the books are filled with the author's observations and recollected conversations with the war criminals, as well as the author's assertions about the meaning of these interactions. Kelly's book was small and contained no references or footnotes. Kelly was very clear that he was writing a book for the popular reader, not the professional. The cover notes are punchy and provocative. What kind of men were the Nazi overlords? How did they get that way? And could it happen again? A rogues gallery of the arch criminals of all time by the official United States psychiatrist who examined them and learned their most intimate secrets. Kelly trumpeted his credentials, noting that he served as the Nuremberg psychiatrist for 5 months and interviewed the prisoners daily. He mentioned Gilbert, acknowledging him for adapting the intelligence tests, and noted that Gilbert was assigned to my office as an interpreter and at my direction made records of many of the conversations which I had with these prisoners and which are reported in this book. Kelly noted that although most of the defendants spoke fairly good English, sometimes he relied upon an interpreter to prevent misunderstandings. This was all fairly polite, but it was also marking the territory for Kelly and relegating Gilbert to the role of his assistant. In his book, also lacking in notes or references, Gilbert thanked Kelly, prison psychiatrist for the first 2 months, for facilitating my assignment to the Nuremberg jail with free access to all the prisoners. The clause, "for the first 2 months," was certainly not necessary, but it was a way for Gilbert to circumscribe Kelly's role and emphasize his brief tenure at Nuremberg. So, who knew most, Kelly with his experience in Ashcan and Nuremberg, from August 1945 to January 1946, or Gilbert, with his Nuremberg experience from October 1945 to October 1946. The battle of the book shifted to Europe. Kelly's editor at Greenberg wrote him that they had the advantage by being first to publish in the United States, but that, regrettably, Gilbert had beat them to the audience in England. What did they really say? Kelly and Gilbert agreed that the defendants, perhaps with the exception of Hess, were neither legally insane nor psychotic. If the defendants weren't psychotic, what were they? Were they mentally ill at all? And what, by the way, did Kelly and Gilbert mean by mental illness? The irony was that Gilbert, whose training was in social psychology, diagnosed the defendants as narcissistic psychopaths whose lives were deformed by a diseased German culture. Kelly, the expert in psychopathology and forensic psychiatry, saw things from a social-psychological perspective and viewed the defendants as basically ordinary people who were creatures of their environment, influenced by mendacity and bureaucracy. He compounded this assertion by saying that one could find such people anywhere. In 1947, many viewed this claim as a lancinating insult. Kelly and Gilbert also differed massively in style and tone. Kelly, ever sardonic and dispassionate, as compared to Gilbert, humorless and intense. The following selected quotations highlight their differences. Kelly: "Nazism is a sociocultural disease. I had at Nuremberg the purest known Nazi virus cultures, 22 flasks, as it were, to study, strong, dominant, aggressive, egocentric personalities with their lack of conscience are not rare. They can be found anywhere in the country, behind big desks, deciding big affairs. Gilbert. They were ruthlessly aggressive, had emotional insensitivity, and presented with a front of utter amiability. What is in the nature of a disorder? In 1947, how did psychiatry and psychology define mental illness? Gilbert espoused the prevailing view. The Nazis were distinctly other, basing his understanding on the burgeoning literature describing psychopathy. Gilbert concluded that psychopaths were so profoundly different in their worldview that they wore a mask of sanity. Kelly's view, by contrast, was profoundly out of sync with 1947, but it anticipated the developing field of social psychology, which noted that under the wrong conditions, decent people could make appalling life choices. Kelly and Gilbert fundamentally disagreed about the nature of diagnosis. Gilbert felt that the Nazis represented a unique category of psychopathology. Kelly saw nothing distinctly different about the Nazis, but saw their behavior as one end of a continuum of behavior. Edmund Burke, the great British statesman, framed the contrast between categories and continuums vividly in a different context. Though no man can draw a stroke between the confines of day and night, yet light and darkness are upon the whole tolerably distinguishable. That is, day fades into night gradually. Nonetheless, the two are distinctive. Gilbert, in essence, focused on day versus night, but Kelly considered the zones in between, dawn and twilight, more interesting to study. What is served by labeling the Nazi leader's behavior as psychiatric disorder, for example, Gilbert's narcissistic psychopaths, or as an example of profound moral failing, Kelly's view? In reality, these are not alternatives, but rather separate questions. Psychiatric disorders are largely characterized by thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are distressing and impairing, but are all repugnant behaviors disorders? Legal systems are finally beginning to tease the issue apart into two separate questions. Is a disorder present? And is the individual responsible for his or her actions? As a thought experiment, consider the following four court scenarios, which play out frequently in theme and variation in contemporary courthouses. 1. A psychotic individual in the thrall of delusions and hallucinations may never be brought to trial because he or she is unable to understand the trial or assist in the defense. 2. A patient whose paranoid schizophrenia is in remission may receive a lesser sentence if the crime was committed under the influence of hallucinations. 3. A person who committed a crime under the influence of amphetamine-induced delusions would probably receive a stiffer sentence because there was an element of volition in choosing to use drugs in the first place. 4. Courts would likely impose the most severe sentence on an individual with a personality disorder who has a long history of impulsive violence and shallow interpersonal sensitivity. These four examples demonstrate the range and diversity of psychiatric disorders and how they may influence our society's judgments of the perpetrator's responsibility. Unfortunately, such nuances did not appear in the acrimonious arguments between Kelly and Gilbert about the nature of the Nazis' diagnoses. Kelly, ever sensitive to the range of suffering in mental illness, saw little to be gained by including narcissistic psychopaths in the same boat as patients with depression or schizophrenia. Indeed, he devoted considerable energy after Nuremberg in helping government agencies to weed out impulsive and aggressive individuals from government service. To Kelly, psychopaths were not mentally ill, rather they were merely unsuitable for government service. To Gilbert, psychopaths bore the mark of Cain. Molly Harrower, the would-be mediator. But how did Kelly and Gilbert use the Rorschach tests to back up their suppositions? Oddly, neither of them extensively discussed the Rorschachs in their books. Kelly wanted confirmation by other Rorschach experts before he would release his Rorschachs, and Gilbert recognized that he was on intellectual thin ice in providing a scholarly analysis of the Rorschachs. Kelly and Gilbert trusted only one person in common, Molly Harrower, a Rorschach scholar who had been raised in South Africa and was active in the arts as a dancer, painter, and poet. She eventually settled in the United States and obtained her doctorate in psychology, completed a postdoctorate at Rockefeller University, and then moved to the Montreal Neurological Institute to work with the eminent neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield on the brain and emotion. When World War II started, she began to use the Rorschach to screen military recruits, thereby acquiring massive datasets of Rorschach responses from many types of subjects. Her congeniality helped her persuade fractious groups to work together for the common good. She even persuaded Kelly and Gilbert to agree provisionally to bury the hatchet. It was an agreement stitched together with very thin thread. In 1947, Heroer began planning for an international mental health congress in London, where she hoped to have the Nuremberg Rorschachs available for review and discussion. Having been appointed editor of a new series of books to be published by Charles Thomas, Heroer was in a position to disseminate the Rorschach findings, both at the meeting and in print. Meanwhile, Kelly and Gilbert were squabbling and accusing each other of having purloined each other's notes. It was a serious business, and frankly, hard to adjudicate. If Kelly performed the interviews, and Gilbert translated, and then later summarized the interviews, whose property was it? Kelly described the complexity of the situation to his publisher. "Since both of us were present at these interviews, actually I think they only include 3 or 4 conversations, it would seem to be reasonable that both of us should use them. If Gilbert, however, wants to put up a squawk, there is no doubt whatsoever that the conversations were mine, and his official position was exclusively that of interpreter secretary. I have been very careful in our book to avoid the use of the intelligence findings which Gilbert did himself, although at my direct order. Consequently, I have no fear of any problems arising from their side, although we are clearly in a position to put the screws on them if we want." Both planned follow-up books that would focus on the Rorschachs and were determined to get there first. Kelly threatened to sue Gilbert if he used Kelly's Rorschach materials. Heroer pieced together a reasonable but doomed-to-fail compromise by suggesting that they collaborate on one book in which each would have his own chapters discussing his own Rorschach findings, with commentary from independent Rorschach experts supplementing the chapters. In the meantime, she worried about Gilbert, writing a colleague in October 1947 to share her concerns that Gilbert was so affected by the conflicts with Kelly that it was adversely affecting him personally and his work. For a very short while, it looked as if the compromise would work. But as it started to unravel, Heroer chronicled the failure in a series of letters now buried in the archives. The intellectual division of territory was not that controversial. Kelly and Gilbert could agree about who would write each chapter, but Gilbert started sniping that he doubted Kelly's truthfulness and suspected that Kelly had doctored his records. Then Gilbert insisted on being first author and relegating Kelly to a status of "with the assistance of Goldenson and Kelly." Not Kelly, even as a third author, but "with the assistance of," to denote his clearly peripheral status. To make matters worse, Gilbert decided he did not want Rorschach experts commenting on his contributions and referred to them in his correspondence with Molly as "the experts," in quotation marks, implying that he questioned their expertise. He was also reluctant to acknowledge the experts as co-authors on the monograph. Nonetheless, Heroer and Gilbert identified the Rorschach experts and drafted a letter. Molly gave Gilbert her letterhead and he sent out the invitation letters on her behalf, but he set the deadline date for an impractically short interval. After receiving the Rorschachs, almost all of the experts declined. Imagine if you received a letter on behalf of Molly Heroer, gracious and world-renowned, asking if you would look at the protocols that might address the most troubling question of the day, the mind of the Nazi war criminals. Imagine if she invited you to discuss your findings and offered to publish them in a book series she was editing. How could you turn her down? Maybe some experts would have schedule difficulties, but almost all declined. Perhaps they were offended by the short deadline. However, Heroer offered 2 other explanations. By then, everyone in the field knew of the acrimony between Kelly and Gilbert, and did not want to get mired down in a dispute that threatened lawsuits, Kelly wrote to Harrower, "I am determined, through our board of trustees and legal advisors, to bring an injunction and suit about Gilbert if this material appears. I have simply turned the whole thing en masse over to our legal staff. They point out that permanent prevention of such unethical publication will be difficult, since the material is not copyrighted, but they feel that an injunction would blast the whole thing into the public eye with sufficient publicity to require that the Ethics Committee of the American Psychiatric Association hold a formal hearing. The publisher obviously does not realize he is publishing stolen goods." In addition to the threats of legal action, Harrower thought that there was another reason why colleagues had declined to comment on the Rorschach tests. The experts felt an odd sense of unease. "We expected the Rorschach would reveal an idiosyncratic psychopathology, a uniform personality structure of a particularly repellent kind. We espoused a concept of evil which dealt in black and white, sheep and goats. Our concept of evil was such that it must be a tangible, scorable element in psychological tests. The records did not show what we expected to see, and what the pressure of public opinion demanded that we see, that these men were demented creatures, as different from normal people as a scorpion is different from a puppy. For all of these reasons, the experts were too busy to participate in the project." For a short time, there seemed to be a grudging truce between Kelly and Gilbert. Then the nastiness resumed. In September 1947, Kelly wrote disparagingly about Gilbert. "He continually startles me by his apparent neglect of basic ethics, and it is this sort of thing that makes me wonder whether we can get together." Gilbert fired back with multiple letters, raging that he wouldn't stand for any more of Kelly's nonsense and disparaging Kelly's work as pathetic. After this fusillade, Kelly and Gilbert again threatened each other with legal action, should either publish material about the Rorschachs, even though this meant that their work would be held hostage by their quarrels. In a flurry of letters, Gilbert indicated how impatient he was to get the work in print, and how furious he was that the process had stalled. After peppering Harrower and her publisher, Charles Thomas, with questions about how soon his second book might appear, he then committed a major scholarly faux pas by submitting virtually the same manuscript to another publisher, W. W. Norton, without informing Harrower or her publisher. How was this discovered? Before publishing the book, W. W. Norton wanted an expert to read the manuscript and advise whether to publish Gilbert's work. The blind reviewer was Molly Harrower. It was an uncomfortable coincidence. Harrower was incensed. This was her thanks for being a peacemaker. The letters went back and forth. Harrower, Gilbert, W. W. Norton, Charles C. Thomas, and ultimately both publishers declined to publish Gilbert's book. When Gilbert eventually published his second book, Psychology of Dictatorship, with Ronald Press, he again omitted the Rorschach data, possibly because of Kelly's legal threats, but also perhaps because of his own lack of expertise with the Rorschachs. As Eric Zillmer and co-authors summarized shrewdly, it was as if Gilbert found himself in the possession of a large cache of foreign money, but did not know how to exchange it. Many people had been bruised by the time this fight burned itself out. One of the proposed Rorschach experts wrote Harrower in January 1948, commenting, "Regarding the Kelly-Gilbert controversy, you must recall that psychologists are human beings. In fact, that is the whole problem, namely, that human beings are human beings. I am fortunate in having a slight reserve of philosophical attitude. I think it may have something to do with my survival." Decades later, referring to other vitriolic arguments concerning Holocaust research, historian Ian Kershaw observed, "It often seemed that emotionality, from whatever its motives, had overtaken rationality. Given the subject matter, that was understandable, but still regrettable." Kelly's later years. When Kelly left Europe in 1946, he settled initially at Bowman Gray Medical School, now Wake Forest School of Medicine, where he lectured widely on his Nuremberg experience and gave many press interviews. Finally, an opportunity emerged for him to return to California as professor of criminology at Berkeley.
He moved into an elegant home on the outskirts of Berkeley and filled his study with memorabilia from Nuremberg, photographs, packets of food that Hess had saved as evidence of poisoning, letters from Goering, slides of Robert Ley's brain, and transcripts. Kelly flourished at Berkeley. His forensic work mushroomed, and he helped police departments and the Atomic Energy Commission in personnel selection, relying on the Rorschach as a key tool. He directed a TV show on science for KQED. He was a psychiatric consultant to Hollywood on Rebel Without a Cause. He wrote an astonishingly large number of book reviews and still had time for magic, becoming vice president of the Society for American Magicians. In short, the man was a dynamo, but it was clear that his wheels were spinning too rapidly. Lewis Terman wrote to Kelly, gently cautioning him to slow down. "I am amazed by the number of activities you are engaged in, and can't help but wonder whether it is too many for your long-range professional good." Kelly's drinking increased, as did his irritability. Years later, his son commented, "He was a cross between a sponge and a rampaging bull. He was a Renaissance man on speed." Sadly, it all ended on January 1, 1958. Kelly had gotten enraged with his wife, ran upstairs to his study, and returned to the living room, where he killed himself in front of his parents, his wife, and his children. The suicide was a devastating end to a brilliant, troubled man, but what also stood out was his mode of suicide: cyanide. Everyone was quick to note the link to Nuremberg and Goering. These two individuals, so close, had chosen the same end: suicide with cyanide. Dark questions and speculations were raised as to where Kelly got the cyanide. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that Kelly's poison was brought back from the war criminal trials. The New York Times took the matter further, stating that the cyanide was one of several capsules Dr. Kelly had brought home from Nuremberg. The capsules had been discovered on Hermann Goering. And Molly Harrower went even further, asserting that Goering had given Kelly the pill when Kelly visited him in jail. None of this was proven, but one fact was clear. At the age of 45, this brilliant, complex man's life was over. People were disinclined to look through his files or trouble his family. The files were there, but they were out of sight, moldering in cartons and forgotten. It required considerable sleuthing to unearth them. Some files were sent to the archive section at the University of California, Santa Cruz, although there was no logical reason why they wound up there. Kelly's family kept other files, and they are documented in Jack L. High's excellent book about Kelly and Goering. Molly Harrower had yet other files that are now archived in the University of Akron, and Columbia University houses the files of Kelly's publisher, Greenberg. Gilbert's later years. Gustav Gilbert left Nuremberg in 1946, moving to Princeton University and then to Michigan State, before eventually returning to New York, where he was a longtime faculty member and chair of psychology at Long Island University. His lectures about Nuremberg were described by his students as riveting, but others have been less charitable, suggesting that some of his observations did not add up and were self-serving, puffing himself up at the expense of Kelly. In 1961, Gilbert's expertise with the Nazis was tapped yet again. He testified in Jerusalem at the Adolf Eichmann trial. The court requested his testimony because years before he had interviewed the commandant of Auschwitz, who had disclosed Eichmann's crucial role in orchestrating the mass killings. In addition, the prosecutor requested Gilbert's expert opinion about the psychology of the murderers. To Gilbert's chagrin, the judge ruled that the latter question was irrelevant to Eichmann's guilt, and that aspect of Gilbert's testimony was disallowed. And the Rorschachs moldered. Meanwhile, the Rorschachs rested in file cabinets. They slept like Rip Van Winkle while the world went on. Finally, decades after they were administered, Gilbert's Rorschachs were published in 1975 by Florence Mialy and Michael Selzer in their book, The Nuremberg Mind. They make one of the nastier ad hominem arguments I have ever seen, dismissing Kelly's Rorschach interpretations as manifestly